Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is your host, Dale Grimm, and welcome to Masonic Home Companion on this 26th day of July, 2015. Magnificent. This is the 207th day of the year. So much going on around us. It's the moon is waxing gibbous. About 90%, maybe a little bit beyond. All that means is that it's a phase when the moon is more than 50% illuminated, but not yet a full moon. And it lasts around 7 days, and then it becomes more and more illuminated each day until the full moon. And during this, during a waxing gibbous, the moon will rise in the east. In mid-afternoon, it will be high in the eastern sky at sunset. So take a look. You actually, last evening, it was quite easily visible. The skies around here were clear. In the east, just take up a look. No hint intended for Masons out there. And it'll be visible through most of the night sky. And it just sets a few hours before sunrise. So even gibbous, for the word even first appeared in the 14th century and has its roots in the Latin word gibbosus, meaning humpbacked. And if you look at it, you get to see little, this little humpback shape. So this is an interesting day in history. This is the day, the July 26, 1524, was the day that James I became the King of Scotland. Yeah, I had forgotten that valuable tip. The Joseph I, the Emperor, German King and Roman Catholic Emperor, was born in Habsburg in this day in 1678. But today I want to talk to you. I have some questions to put to you, and I need the think tank out there to help me resolve these questions in a Masonic framework. And I know that you're much more capable of doing this than I am, but I want to help explain a few things that may have crossed the mind of some of the listeners. We're going to look for answers to Masonic context in literature. And I think you'll find it very welcome. The potential for the order lies ahead of us. So let's consider for a moment that our management of the craft, our stewardship of the craft, is running along as it should. We are good stewards of the craft. That said, we also might be thinking about the men of vision that will visit us occasionally and will help to redefine, reshape, and excite the imagination and expand the notions of Freemasonry in a way that's compelling for in a contemporary and future setting. Just as we find that there were men, what inspires us most about them from the past is that they themselves are men that could be inspired. Whether they're, and we see this in the ghosts that hang on our walls, the faces, the often grim-faced black and white photos, a ghost because there's no story about the man, why he is significant, perhaps other than in that you'll see what he was, not who he was. We'll see that he was some form of leader in the community, which tells us very little about the actual person. The things that inspire Masonry isn't that you clamor to rank and fortune, that you're competitive and that you're a success in business terms. What defines a man is far more deeper than that. None of that. That is relatively superficial in the minds of contemplative, serious-minded people. As Joseph Campbell reminds us, find a place inside where there's joy, and the joy will burn out the pain. Your life is the fruit of your own doing. You have no one to blame but yourself. We must let go of the life we have planned so as to accept the one that is waiting for us. I think the great architect of the universe does have a first name, and that first name is time. Time takes us along. Time helps us to forget. It helps us to revere. It helps us to select the things most important. Today we're finding that there is change happening around us. We're more reminded of that than perhaps in the past. If we were in a field 300 years ago tending to whatever business we had out there, change was still occurring at the same pace around us. Our awareness of that change may not have been what it is today. Now, what seems to be growing is human knowledge. The amount of material that we can track has exponentially left our history in sort of as a starting point. And if you think about it, that's quite a remarkable platform for what's being launched around us, where in a few years, the amount of knowledge accessible by humanity will be doubling within the course of days. This isn't necessarily a daunting or bad thing. It's an interesting observation. Like turning on a light switch is an interesting observation, interesting event. If you give it some thought, it reveals quite a bit, not only about the world and the universe around us, but also about you. More likely that we see people flapping their little hands and arms and carrying on about how everything new is bad and that change is bad, really displaying in an embarrassing kind of a way their discomfort with this phenomena that has been part of life from the first instant. From that second of the Big Bang or nanosecond of the Big Bang. Change. Neither good nor bad. It is what it is. And it has allowed us to exist and develop into, and when we develop histories, we begin to have a sense of culture, and a sense of civilization comes from order and predictability. So as we're seeing going on around the world, where some countries are referred to as developed and others as undeveloped, we're able to examine that big, beautiful blue marble that lingers in the universe floating around our star, and look at the business of the tribes, the people, the population of that blue marble at any time of our own choosing. We have billions of Twitter feeds every single day. This has gone beyond something that we can tongue-in-cheek giggle about. This is a phenomena that is changing the way we're thinking. And now, the things about masonry that fit into this is that the things that are bad for masonry are the things that are barriers. Whatever it is, for whatever reason, the barriers will be overrun by time and by progress, no matter, because simply said, the change will affect the order is constantly, as it is now, is constantly affecting the change in the way we think about each other. And that certainly fits beautifully with the philosophy of Freemasonry. Open your bliss and the universe will open doors where there were only walls. We have been taught about the walls of a lodge. And you and I have spoken about the sanctuary inside those walls that allow contemplative appetites to begin to engage. And it's a welcoming introduction. It is not in itself the totality of masonry, of course not. But to open the doors of your mind requires following your bliss. What is then your bliss? I think the person who takes a job in order to live, that is to say, for the money, has turned himself into a slave, says Joseph Campbell. Opportunities to find deeper powers within ourselves come when life seems most challenging. When we face challenge, opportunity. It's a remarkable way of thinking. Here's the episode for today, The Artistry of Freemasonry. When did we become complacent? Oh, was it when the mystery became boring? Hardly imaginable. Was it that the philosophy became too difficult to grasp? Was McLuhan correct? The message is in the media? Are we trained to think in sound bites, detached of emotion, left with no time to assimilate ideas before rushing to the next tragedy or act that appeals to the salacious primitive mind? You know, better to have that little shocking scene of the car accident and see somebody in their misery as entertainment. None of that. The training for the ideal that a Mason who lives an unassuming life with insight was never a populist movement and is not more so today. Remember, if you see a man, remember that interesting little story. That's never been popular. It's never been something that's been at the test, the parameter of Freemasonry, to become that man. But in a way, when we hear that, it's something that we begin to realize is the goal. We were left no time to assimilate the idea. The essence of the master craftsman, those rare talents, were protected by a loyal group, able to hold the idea in mind as the primary context in which we judge performance. Those rare talents. Not what's common, not what's popular, but those rare talents. It takes many laborers doing the practical job. In a sense, within the lodge is a diversified membership, each bringing their particular skill to the workplace. Would lodges lacking this diversification be able to complete the cathedral? Of course not. So celebrate the diversification. Try to step away from the peaks and quarrels, the shortcomings of personalities. They are what they are, embarrassments for grown men. But remember, it's easier to focus on the fact that of all of the, when we have a task in mind, and sometimes we, when we don't have the goal and task in mind, it's difficult to do this. But when you have the task in mind, we're achieving the development of a cathedral that may not be finished in our lifetime. The cathedral is, of course, that metaphor for us, for our mind, for the development of character. This isn't development of thought, I don't think, because we are encouraged to consider Freemasonry as an active pursuit, an active lifestyle. That's the artistry of Freemasonry, that standard, not popular, but the skills demonstrated by a rare, talented person, the one in 100,000 that comes along. Well, change? Of course change is going to happen, and we will embrace that change because we're going to be able to understand more. People in public can understand more about Freemasonry today because they study. Whether they are a boy or a girl, whether they are supportive or just curious, hopefully they'll be curious about the principles of this largely, in a practical sense, group of men who value a sense of gentlemanly private occasion. We are going to be under pressure about our sense of only boys being allowed. Eventually, that's a barrier that's going to fall, going to fail, because it's built on a foundation of sand. And will this happen in my lifetime? Well, there's other questions to ask that will reveal when that might occur. Fascinating. Yeah, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about, listen, the things that fascinate us here at Masonic Home Companion. Before I go on, I want to do a shout out. I want to say hi, hello, and an acknowledgement to all of you who value this kind of conversation. Whether you can get out to your lodge or not, we wish you well, and the thoughts and best wishes of the lodge is always expressed to us if we're not able to attend. Personally, I don't like to be referred to as a shut-in, because I'm not. If I'm not attending, if you're not attending, if we are not attending, where in the world did we get the notion that attending all of these events that can consume every evening of a man's life here in Ontario easily is considered a trait of a good and dedicated Mason? Where in the world did that come from? I think that was made up about the time when our ability to calculate our acceptance of the esoteric nature of Freemasonry, our acceptance of that has failed somehow or changed. We no longer want to calculate when our lodge meetings are based on lunar lodges, you know, the second Wednesday after the full moon or the first Wednesday after the full moon, as my mother lodge originally was, became too complicated because our modern schedules, our contemporary schedules didn't allow it. That's a bit of conceit. The schedules of our farmers and merchants of the 19th and 17th and 18th and 19th century were every bit as complicated. There was consequences for making those kinds of calculations. To think today that they were a cost that we can't bear reflects more on our willingness to pay that price, not on any excusable reasoning that we are simply, it's inconvenient or we're too busy. That's just we've just made that up. I want to ask you a personal question. Can we talk? we have a great many metaphors that refer to architecture, and you will know from one of the lectures that we go through five of them, and some of them are real and we can see, and one of them is a composite, a fabrication put in there for what? Some interesting, very, very interesting reasons. But I want to ask, I've been thinking, I believe some of you out there have been doing the same. Why Greek architecture? Why not Egyptian architecture? Like, when you think about the geometry, why not the geometry of the East? It's profound in itself. And these monuments are still with us in Egypt. So when Anderson and is it a constitutional event? I don't know if it's constitutional, but it is. It's a something that's part of us to speak in our. Even when we look at the different rituals, there is reference about masonry and about architecture, the cathedrals. It's all part of our wonderfully enriched and lively history, whether you're jumping down the rabbit hole or you're poking your head out of it. It's part of it. But I want to ask you, why do you think we picked, why of all of them, would Greek architecture make the most sense? Well, I've been looking through so-called Masonic papers for a long time, and I haven't found any reference to that. Most of the references that I hear are based on assumptions that are just unchallenged, which is remarkable, just remarkable that we would take this opportunity for discourse, this opportunity for gentlemanly debate, and set that aside, ignore it. In effect, give it away. Miss the opportunity that's been handed to us. Ignore the, and to do it deliberately seems somehow a step backwards. So, I'm looking at a piece of material on Victorian prose and poetry. This is from a book that I picked up in 1974. It's an Oxford University press in Toronto by Lionel Trilling from Columbia University and Harold Bloom from Yale University. And the part that was really, really caught my eye was written by an interesting fellow. I'm going to tell you about this man, and then reveal how this has a bearing on masonry. This is an article by an art critic named John Ruskin. He was born in 1819 on the 8th of February, and he was a leading English art critic of the Victorian era. And he was a draftsman and a watercolorist. But the part, and I know that some of you out there are painters and. But you might share the fact that he was a prominent social thinker and a philanthropist. And he wrote many, many articles. He was hugely influential in the later half of the 19th century. In all his writings, he emphasized connections between nature and art and society. And he had a very elaborate style that characterized his earliest writings on art, and it was later superseded by a preference for much plainer language designed to communicate his ideas. But after a period of relative decline, his reputation has steadily improved since the 60s, particularly with the publication of numerous academic studies of his work. When you realize, here's somebody that's been working in obscurity and somebody else discovers the brilliance in that so-called obscure effort. Well, that's what happened with John Ruskin. His work focused on social and political issues. And in 1871, he began monthly letters to the workmen and laborers of Great Britain, published under the title of Fours Clavigera. And he founded the Guild of St. George, an organization that endures today. I've met people in Niagara Falls that John Ruskin, he was the only child of first cousins. His father, James John Ruskin, was a sherry and wine importer, and so his family was fairly well off. John was born and brought up in Edinburgh, Scotland, and his wife, he married a woman named Mary Cox, and she was the daughter of an aunt on the English side of the family, and a publican. She was a publican. Imagine that. She, as she grew up, became a companion to John's mother, Catherine. So John had wanted to become a lawyer, but instead articled as a clerk in London. And his father, John, was described as a grocer, but was apparently very, very ambitious wholesale merchant. But he wasn't a very, very good businessman, and the family did go into bankruptcy. And that's where John learned some important lessons about prudence and the nature of success. And he himself became very successful, and he took on all of the debts for his father, and he settled the last of them in 1832. But it was this man that wrote a book that I'm going to introduce to you called The Nature of Gothic. Now, this is a chapter which is put before the reader, can be well considered as a separate piece of work, although it contains references to what has gone on before in that chapter called The Stones of Venice. To when we first read it, it seems to be a point to point out a new road on which the world should travel. And in spite of all the disappointments of many years, John Ruskin learned what the equipment for that journey must be. Of course, this would get the attention. Ruskin teaches us that art is the expression of man's pleasure in labor, that it is possible for man to rejoice in his work. Strange as that may seem for us today, that there have been times when he did rejoice in it in the past, that unless man's work once again becomes a pleasure to him, the token of which change will be that beauty is once again a natural and necessary accompaniment of productive labor. It seems that he explained truisms. It follows that the hallowing of labor by art is one aim for us at the present day. If politics are to be anything else than an empty game, more exciting but less innocent than those which are confessed games of skill, it is toward this goal of the happiness of labor that they must make. Science has in these later days made such stupendous strides and is attended by such support, many of whom our supporters are doubtless single-hearted and worship not riches and power, but the casket of knowledge, as he says. So, fast forward to somewhere around 1856. in comfortable, got a nice, you're pushing back in your van, you've got your cup of coffee beside you. Are you in your overstuffed chair? Are you in your desk chair? Have a sip of whatever's nearby. Let's see. This is called the nature of Gothic. The principal difficulty he talks about, and he was known as a literary critic. In this chapter is to give the reader an idea, broad and definite, on the true nature of Gothic architecture. Not that of Venice, but of universal Gothic. For it will be one of the most interesting parts of our subsequent inquiry to find out how far Venetian architecture reached the universal or perfect type of Gothic. As it is this Gothicness, the character of which, is found more or less in a building, makes it more or less Gothic, of which I want to define the nature. Here they gives us six elements of Gothic architecture in their order of importance and lengthy explanations that I'm not going to take your time with today. Savageness or rudeness, love of change, love of nature, disturbed imagination, that's the grotesques, yeah. Obstinacy, being rigid, and generosity or redundance. And he repeats that the withdrawal of any one or two will not at once destroy the Gothic character of a building, but the removal of a majority of them will. In the 13th and 14th paragraphs of the work, The Stones of Venice, around chapter 21, the first volume of the work, we notice a system of architectural ornament, properly so called because it's divided into three. Servile ornament, in which the execution or power of the inferior workman is entirely subject to the intellect of the higher. Constitutional ornament, in which the executive inferior power is to a certain point emancipated and independent, having will of its own, yet confessing its inferiority and rendering obedience to higher powers. And revolutionary ornament, in which no executive inferiority is admitted at all. I must explain the nature of the divisions a little more. Servile ornament. The principal schools are Greek and the Ninevite and the Egyptian, but their servility is of different kinds. The Greek master workman was far advanced in knowledge and power above the Assyrian or Egyptian. Neither he nor those for whom he worked could endure the appearance of imperfection in anything. And therefore, what ornament he appointed to be done by those beneath him was composed of mere geometrical forms, balls, ridges, and perfectly symmetrical foliage, which could be executed with absolute precision by line and rule, and were as perfect in their way when completed as his own figure sculpture. The Assyrian and Egyptian, on the contrary, less cognizant of accurate form in anything, were content to allow their figure sculpture to be executed by inferior workmen, but lowered the method of its treatment to a standard which every workman could reach, and then trained him by discipline so rigid that there was no chance of his falling beneath the standard appointed. The Greek gave to the lower workman no subject which he could not perfectly execute. The Assyrian gave him subjects which he could only execute imperfectly, but fixed a legal standard for this imperfection. The workman was in both systems a slave. But in the medieval, or especially Christian, system of ornament, this slavery is done away with altogether. Christianity, having recognized in small things as well as great, the individual value of every soul. But it not only recognizes its value, it confesses its imperfection in only bestowing dignity upon the acknowledgement of unworthiness. That admission of loss of power and fallen nature, which the Greek or Ninevite felt to be intensely painful, and as far as might altogether refuse, the Christian makes daily and hourly, contemplating the fact of it without fear, as tending, in the end, to God's greater glory. Therefore, in every spirit which Christianity summons to her service, her exhortation is this: do what you can, and confess frankly what you are unable to do. Neither let your effort be shortened by fear of failure, nor your confession silenced by fear of shame. And it is perhaps the principal admirableness of the Gothic schools of architecture that they thus receive the results of the labor of inferior minds, and out of fragments full of imperfection and portraying that imperfection in every touch, indulgently rise up at a stately and unaccusable whole. But the modern English mind has this much in common with that of the Greek, that it intensely desires in all things the utmost completion or perfection compatible with this nature. This is a noble character in the abstract, but becomes ignoble when it causes us to forget the relative dignities of that nature itself, and to prefer the perfectness of the lower nature of the imperfection of the higher, not considering that, as judged by all such a rule, all the brute animals would be preferable to man, because more perfect in their functions and kind, and yet are always held inferior to him. So also in the works of man, those which are more perfect in their kind are always inferior to those which are, in their nature, liable to more faults and shortcomings. For the finer the nature, the more flaws it will show through the clearness of it. And it is a law of this universe that the best things shall be seldomest seen in their best form. The wild grass grows well and strongly, one year with another, but the wheat is, according to the greater nobleness of its nature, liable to the bitterer blight. Therefore, while in all things that we see or do, we are to desire perfection and strive for it, we are nevertheless not to set the meaner thing in its narrow accomplishment above the nobler thing. In its mighty progress, not to esteem smooth minuteness above shattered majesty, not to prefer mean victory to honorable defeat, not to lower the level of our aim that we may the more surely enjoy the complacency of success. Now, in the make and nature of every man, however rude or simple, who we employ in manual labor, there are some powers for better things, some tardy imagination, torpid capacity for emotion, tottering steps of thought, there are even at the worst. And in most cases, it is all our own fault that they are tardy or torpid. But they cannot be strengthened unless we are content to take them in their feebleness, and unless we prize and honor them in their imperfection above the best and most perfect manual skill. And this is what we have to do with all our laborers, to look for the thoughtful part of them and get that out of them, whatever we lose for it, whatever faults and errors we are obliged to take with it. For the best that is in them cannot manifest itself but in company with much error. Understand this clearly. You can teach a man to draw a straight line and to cut one, to strike a curved line and to carve it, and to copy and carve another number or given lines or forms with admirable speed and perfect precision. And you find his work perfect of its kind. But if you ask him to think about any of those forms, to consider if he cannot find any better in his own head, he stops. His execution becomes hesitating. He thinks, and 10 to 1 he thinks wrong. 10 to 1 he makes a mistake in the first touch he gives to his work as a thinking being. But you have made a man of him for all of that. He was only a machine before, an animated tool. Now tell me, what does that do to our sense of architecture, to our sense of the apprentice, to the purpose and to the goal? Changes that a little bit, more than a little bit. It gives meaning. Ruskin has given in that material an analysis of social connections, of tying in the nature of society and culture and achievement, and the expression of man's pleasure in his handiwork. As Campbell reminds us, I don't believe people are looking for the meaning of life as much as they are looking for the experience of being alive. Just going through the movements, trying to be a dedicated fellow. My, oh my. What about more practical matters? Like the function of an operative mason in 1340, I ask myself. Myths are public dreams. Dreams are private myths. Dream away. Dream away. Had an operative mason in 1340 been concerned with such abstract matters as utopia, he might have constructed a society closely resembling the world of an operative lodge. Masons were bound to their lodge as free men. They worked at their chosen skills to the glory of God. They were under no work or service obligations to some distant lord. They could sell their skills or any produce they might raise from a piece of land. They could hold public office, give evidence in civil or criminal cases, set up their children in a trade, and allow them to marry for love. The individual might seek education for himself or his family. Perhaps most important of all, he could move about without let or hindrance. The obligations of his lodge and the requirements laid upon him as he discharged his duties, embodied in what we now call the ancient charges, were essentially the rules and conditions under which he worked. They must have seemed no more onerous than the guarantee of employment. The lodge was as ordered and disciplined a society as any abbey or community of monks, and doubtless it's much a prey to personal tensions and anxieties as any Browning imagined in his soliloquy of the Spanish cloister. Robert Browning. Yeah. Go and see what the author here, Mike Rogers, is pointing out. Soliloquy of the Spanish cloister is an indication of personal tensions and anxieties. Oh my goodness, I must be right. I have to be right, so I better be mean in order to achieve that. I better be, you know, petty. I need to have my click. Life may not have been soft and easy, but the mason was among fellows he could trust, who lived by the codes he respected and seldom had to fear for either his food or his wages. Whatever infighting occurred about contracts, their delivery and the details of the project happened above his level of concern. He could see and take pride in the fruits of his labors. Beliefs about the possibility of achieving a utopian society or some form of an almost utopian social structure, began to take a more clearly defined shape during the Age of Enlightenment, as perceptive observers noted, and began to ponder the customs of native persons they encountered. For those observations and musings, they began to weave the myth of the noble savage. During his service in North America with Montcalm in the 1750s, Bougainville developed an admiration for the social fabric of the people of the Longhouse. The five tribes of the Mohawks, Oneidas, Senecas, Onondagas, and Cayugas. Under no illusions about their fundamental savagery, he admired their democratic form of organization, the absence of any formal state apparatus, and the virtual gender-free character of their society. As a European, accustomed to the paraphernalia of cumbersome state machinery, he marveled at the society without a state, a communal economic system that functions without coercion within a framework of remarkable political sophistication. There is no record of his having observed any form of peer group criticism or social disapproval that is known to have existed among his primitive peoples. In the 1760s, while serving as a naval officer, he explored the islands of the Pacific and found among the islanders a not dissimilar world that was to lay the foundations for the enduring myth of the noble savage. These ideas certainly became the talk of the French court and beyond. Charles Fourier created a world in which all passions were deemed to be God-given and therefore to be cherished and indulged. To allow the complete array of human passions to range freely and completely toward their total realization and fulfillment. A complicated system of checks and balances, meetings, and monitors was to be established. These systems would seek to match taste with taste, inclination with inclination, until the world evolved in harmony, with no person feeling excluded and no passion left unsated. Fourier's theory was based upon an assumption that civilized society creates its own evils by stifling passions deemed to be uncivilized. Such evils could be resolved by placing individuals in situations where their God-given inclinations can be given free rein. In this way, the two-thirds of male children whom he presumed enjoy playing in filth would be employed as latrine or street cleaners. Those with bloodthirsty tendencies would become slaughtermen, and so forth. In this way, a world would be created where human activity would begin in order, be conducted in peace, and culminate in harmony, an almost Masonic vision. What it lacked was any form of personal challenge or development. The emphasis was wholly upon personal gratification, with scant thought to how the initial identifications were to be carried out. People would be in some way gravitate toward those areas of life and work within the community where they felt most comfortable, and so a utopian society based on harmony would prevail. Flawed though this argument undoubtedly was, Fourier is inching toward the notion of an idealized society in which there is an early echo of Freemasonry. He would have been very comfortable with the words, "May our labors thus begun in order be conducted in peace and closed in harmony," for that was what his utopia was intended to deliver. From a Masonic standpoint, a key document, New Atlantis, had appeared in 1627, written by Francis Bacon. Early science fiction novel sets out to show how science will transform the world. We will carry on the next time we meet. The notion of utopia. Charles Fourier putting out the idea and defining an idea that later we find assimilated into the thinking of Freemasonry. Oh, we're certainly not thinking that this was created by the members of lodges that formed an organization. But certainly not. These were well-read academics. Whether they were amateur or professional academics, they were well-read. Businessmen, scientists, clergy, responsible people who had a deep appetite for the development of character. And we, you and me, can be very, very grateful. So the potential for Freemasonry always lies ahead of us. What's in the past is this enriched foundation, this enriched, incredibly interesting history. But it's a history that has threads to the contemporary environment. I'll leave it at that. It's been amazing having you join us today. And as Campbell said, love is a friendship set to music. What better way to express that than to step out of Masonic Home Companion with a little music to soothe the soul. Remember, myths are public dreams. Dreams are private myths. Hope to see you all soon.